Okay, I want to take this opportunity to thank Rabbi Goldberger for his very enlightening presentation. Again, thank all of you for braving the snow, the winter weather. One good word, it's worse than New York. Thank you once again to the other organizations who have helped our shul sponsor this event, the congregations Feres Yisrael, Yeshiva University, and Pharmacite Research. Again, it was a beautiful collaboration, all coming together for this very wonderful event. It is a very special, a personal privilege to be able to introduce, I believe for the first time, from the pulpit of Shomrei Emuna, Dr. David Palkovitz. Dr. Palkovitz is already, quite frankly, a nationally renowned psychologist, both generally and especially in the Jewish and the Orthodox community. But I'm happy to say that beyond his national and well-earned reputation, my relationship goes back with him already quite a few years, and is a very personal one. Not because I necessarily had to sit on his couch, although it is a very personal relationship. I think sometimes it's evolved in that kind of a relationship, and I wouldn't be embarrassed if it had. But because I was fortunate that as Dr. Palkovitz first started getting into the training of rabbis, I was in the first class of smicha students, which he taught as part of his pastoral counseling class to rabbinical students. And in fact, I had Dr. Palkovitz, I think, 5 or 6 semesters. And it really made a lasting impression and a bond for me. And as I try in my own way to help people who come to me for help, many of the lessons that I learned going back now 5 and 6 and 7 years ago from Dr. Palkovitz really have been helpful, inspirational to me. Over those years, Dr. Palkovitz's professional titles have changed. He's switched from being the head mental health professional at a major New York hospital to recently becoming a full-time faculty member at Yeshiva University, and that is certainly to the great schus of the yeshiva and all of its talmidim. And yet at the same time, Dr. Palkovitz has continued with his help of private individuals as well as many different organizations. I can tell you from just some of the experiences that I've had hearing Dr. Palkovitz teach, it's a remarkable thing. I'm not sure if there's anybody else like Dr. Palkovitz in which you can have, whether it's day schools or, for that matter, communal or rabbinical organizations, literally, if I may be political for a moment, from the right all the way over to the left and everything in between within the Orthodox community, literally, from the most Hasidic communities, we've turned to Dr. Palkovitz for his help, to the most modern of day schools, all of whom have seen this great wisdom and the great potential for help in this remarkable professional. Like Rabbi Goldberger, also the son of a rabbi, I hope that bodes well for my children. And that's really a great privilege. Just so you know, some of you may, Dr. Palkovitz, just in the last few years, has been the guest of the Vada Rabbanim twice. Even though he's perhaps more well-known in New York, his reputation is already preceding him now into Baltimore, and we look forward for more opportunities to be able to have him. It's a great personal kavod to call upon one of my rebbeim, Dr. David Palkovitz, to speak on the topic of honorable mention, raising children with character, maturity, and communal responsibility. Dr. Palkovitz.
Thank you so much for your very kind words, Rabbi Gottlieb. The community is so fortunate to have you, because I just wanted to say that having had him, we kept having him come back to a class until he passed, but no, he was clearly taking all those classes in pastoral psychology because of how much he values and wanted to learn and grow in that aspect of Rabbanus. And I know that it shows from what I'm hearing about the important work that you're doing here. So thank you. And let me talk. 45 minutes, they say. Okay. That doesn't look like 45 minutes worth, but I'll see what I could do. The topic is a great topic. Dr. Laston came up with the very catchy title of Honorable Mention, which I like. And I guess I'll start with that. I'll start with It's a fascinating body of literature in psychology that maybe I'll spend the first section talking about. The literature has to do with what happens if you look at a group of children from birth into adulthood, and you follow them intensively and look at everything that you can about their individual psychological development, their family psychological development, and you ask yourself, once they're adults, who is it that grows up to be a mensch? Who is it that grows up to be an ethical human being? What are some of the family characteristics? What are some of the parenting characteristics of what it takes to build a mensch? It's just a basic question. And here, obviously, today in this program, the focus is on parenting adolescents in that way, and I'll try to focus on that part of parenting of adolescents and then the transition into young adulthood. But first, let me review with you that basic literature, because it's, I think, important in general. Even as some of us move on into grandparenthood, I think it's important to have an overall kind of sense of what the psychology literature says, which I think is totally consistent with what the Jewish view of this would be. There are a couple of things that come up very, very clearly. Number one is time. Amount of time that parents spent with the child. When a parent truly values time, I don't think it's necessarily, you know, the whole concept of quantity versus quality time. I don't think it's that alone. I think it's partly just sort of showing your child that what you value more than almost anything is being able, in spite of your busy schedule, to steal some time away with them. I was hearing from a colleague about one of his clients had gone on a trip during winter recess to Eretz Yisrael. And he asked his kids, what was your favorite part of the trip? And for one of them, it was a trip to the mall in Yerushalayim. For another, it was a trip to the tunnels, under the Kotel area. And for another, it was a trip up to Tzfat. And he was sort of puzzled about it until he realized that for each of his children, that was the time, that was the number of hours that he had spent alone with them. And what they really valued was the one-on-one time. And I know that it's, in a way, a little trite, you know, almost to start with this. I'm almost nervous about starting with it. But I'm starting with it because that component, that ingredient of menschmaking, is sometimes easy to lose sight of when our children hit adolescence and beyond. As we were just hearing so beautifully about the importance of the Hayuei Necharos as Marecha and the importance of valuing grandparents, which is something that's not even looked at. I grew up in a community where almost all of my friends were children of survivors, and they had no grandparents. I had, thank God, the only set of grandparents in town. Thank God for me, but I had the privilege of having grandparents who, some of whom were even American-born. They never believed that my grandmother, who was born on the Lower East Side, could possibly be above me, because she spoke with a perfect, perfect English. But they used to come. Some of my friends used to come to my house when they heard that my grandparents were visiting, just to see what a grandparent looked like, and just to hang around. They were so jealous in a way. And because of that, I think I value that more than I would have otherwise. And that's such an important value for us to remember. And it's the time. It's the time of modeling for our children in all the ways that we model for them that really does instill in them that sense of ethics, that sense of morality. Because what we really learn from our parents has to do with what we observe from them when they don't even know it and we don't even know it in terms of their modeling. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zechut Tzadik Livracha, used to talk about parents as not mechanchim, but as mashpiyim, right? As mashpiyim, right, from the word shipu, Iran. It's what trickles down. And that's what kids really learn from. Are you being honest when your kids are a little bit younger about whether or not they pay full price or half price when they take the train? Are you honest in your dealings with others? Are you speaking about your neighbors and the other members of your community charitably? And that's the way kids really learn, and it's all in the currency of time. In the spirit of the parsha, there's the famous Bar Torah, I forget, maybe one of you can remind me who says this, but talking about the parallel between, you look up there, what's opposite Kabeis Savicha Vesi Mechalo Sacha? What do we learn from that parallel? It's supposed to be significant to that, to what each Dibra is opposite. And why is it that what's opposite Kabeis Avicha Vesimecha is Lo Sacha? It's because the nature of what our children will respect has a lot to do with what we covet. If we covet, and if our Sach mode is about things that really matter and the proper kind of values as opposed to material things or superficial things, then we're going to be giving over a message that will ultimately lead to the proper kind of kibbutz. Okay? So ingredient number one is the ingredient of time, figuring out a way to steal time, and even in adolescence. The research shows, and let me hold it like this. The research shows that that even though it's totally normal for adolescents to not want to be with their parents and to pull away from their parents, in spite of that, you ask any adolescent, what is it that you want to see different in terms of your relationship with your parents? Almost every one of them will say that they wish that they could get more input from their parents. So there's that ambivalence. They both need us and they need to pull away from us. There's that best-selling book about adolescence called Mommy, Get Out of My Life, But First Can You Take Me and Cheryl to the Mall? Right? Great title, says it all. It's that ambivalence. But that dependence is also a dependence. For example, if you ask adolescents what's the number one deterrent to their using drugs, the number one deterrent to using drugs is they're worried about what their parents would think of them. And parents who actively and openly spend time with their children and communicate with them, their children are 3 times less likely to experiment with drugs. Just one piece of it. So to finish the time piece of the mensch-making ingredients, there's a beautiful kutzker that says, "Kachitzim b'yad gibor came b'nei hanurim." It's a beautiful pasuk at the end of Tehillim. The kutzker asks, what's the connection in terms of chinuch habanim between being an archer and raising children or being mechanech children? And the kutzker says that when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Just like with an archer, the closer he holds the bow to his heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes, so too with our children. The closer we hold them to our hearts, the further and straighter they go. So that's take-home message number one in terms of the mensch-making piece is time. Even though our kids may be giving us messages that they really don't want to spend the time with us, figure out a way to do it anyway. They do want to hear from us, and they don't want to hear from us in the form of lecturing or nagging. They develop parent deafness to that kind of stuff. They hate it. But what they do want to hear from us is they want to, maybe sometimes for us to find teachable moments, where we tell them clearly what we feel and what we think about issues that are important to them. So that's number one. Number two, after a time, is in these longitudinal studies about what goes into mensch-making, is a very interesting piece. And I won't go into all of the ingredients for the sake of time, but this one is one that is particularly, I think, important. And that's the issue of families that when they discuss disagreements, they present the viewpoints of others from a position of respect. Such an interesting and unexpected finding. really interesting finding. What they find is that if, when you're sitting around the Shabbos table Friday night or Shabbos the lunch, and you're talking about, I don't know, you disagree with this Rav or that principal or this community leader or that teacher, it's not that you can't disagree as long as you're being careful about, basic Shemira Solution, etc. But what they find in terms of menschmaking is that a key differentiator between families that raise honorable mention and those who don't is that it's the families that present their feelings about people they disagree with from a position of respect. You may disagree with this person or that person, but if you do it in a way that you try to help your child understand that you honor that person who you disagree with, and that you also are trying to figure out, you bring an air of curiosity rather than certainty, to get curious about what makes them feel that way, and you try to help your child understand that person's perspective, even though you totally disagree with them, that's a key contributor. Again, it may not be so much common sense. When you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. Who do you want your children to marry? I know my dream is that one of the main ingredients of who my children find God willing one day to spend the rest of their life with, to marry, is going to be somebody who comes from a family that teaches respect for the views of others. A family that teaches that when you disagree about something, that you could disagree and still like and honor and respect that other person. It's a key building block of menschmaking. And we don't even realize sometimes how, again, that shikua, the ramp, the trickle down to our children is represented in a way that really has far-reaching implications. I once talked about this ingredient of menschmaking at a talk I was giving in the New York area. A Rav came over to me. He was in the audience. He just started to be the Rav of a shul in that area just a couple of months earlier. And he told me that he got a call maybe his second or third week on the job. And it was that somebody in the shul, their son had become engaged to a non-Jew. And they couldn't understand it. They'd given him a yeshiva education and had raised him in a way that they felt they had thrown everything into teaching him the right kind of values. And they said, Rabbi, you don't really know us, but please, can you talk to him? So he called the kid in. And the kid said, let me tell you something. He said, my parents are always very busy. They spent very little time with us. The only time we were together was on Shabbos meals, Friday night and Shabbos lunch. And they were tremendous Machnisei Orchim. They always had people come. And for pretty much my entire childhood, what I heard on Friday night and Shabbos was my parents and their friends complaining about the previous rabbi, my parents and their friends complaining about the principal of the school, my parents and their friends complaining about every person imaginable who was the leader of the Jewish community. And he said, how do you expect me to view Judaism given the fact that this is how I was raised? He said, I developed an antipathy for the religion, and it just pushed me away further and further. And I know it's much more complex than that. But very often, we lose sight of how profoundly we shape our children through the indirect. One more story about this indirect shipua, ramping down effect of parenting in terms of this piece of the ingredient. I don't know if this neighborhood has any Kiddush club activity. Any Kiddush club activity out here? No, not at all. Okay, that's what I figured. You know what a Kiddush club is. Have you heard rumors about Kiddush clubs? Okay. So, the OU, a little over a year ago, put out a public announcement that they wanted to outlaw Kiddush clubs. For those of you who may not be aware of it, I can't imagine. Oh, it's possible. It's usually during Matz Torah, a group of men go out and they make a l'chaim and get a little drunk possibly, and they come back into shul. And it's done in different ways in different neighborhoods. Some neighborhoods it becomes incredibly lavish. I know about a neighborhood where somebody died and left in his savah, in his will, enough money, this is a true story, enough money to build an additional room onto the shul, and enough money that in perpetuity they would put out enough money to have a beautiful catered kiddush every Shabbos for the kiddush club. And they hung up his picture there. And every Shabbos during Haftarah, people would leave and they'd have this wonderful catered kiddush and they'd drink a l'chaim into his memory. Actually, this is one of the shuls that pulled back after they used, and they used the room for other things now. So it wasn't in perpetuity as his dream was. They announced that, that they really want there to be a certain amount of consistency in throughout their constituency getting rid of kiddush clubs. And a lot of people were very upset. They're upset because they felt, as some of my friends said, you know, that they work so hard all week and what's 10 minutes of fun? You're taking away all the fun from us. Where do we have fun? And there was a lot of bad feeling about it in different shuls. Some shuls didn't outlaw it, other shuls did outlaw it. But one of the leaders of that effort to get rid of kiddush clubs was the top executive of OU, Rabbi Moshe Krukpa. And Rabbi Krukpa told me the following story. Rabbi Krukpa told me that the day after the announcement that when kiddush clubs came out, he got a furious phone call from the president of a shul in the New York area. This president of the shul pulled up and started screaming at Rabbi Krukpa, saying, "What's wrong with you guys? Don't have better things to involve yourselves in, and what are you taking away? A little bit of innocent fun." He really laced into Rabbi Krukpa. Rabbi Krukpa tried to explain to him a little bit what the thinking was, but the guy hung up the phone in fury. 3 weeks later, Rabbi Krukpa gets a phone call from this man, this president of the shul, who pulled up to apologize. And he says, "Rabbi, I really owe you an apology." He says, "I have to tell you what happened last night in Madison Square Garden." He said, "Last night in Madison Square Garden, I took my son to a basketball game to see the Knicks. And in the row in front of us, there were a group of teenagers who were like very out of control, who were drinking one beer after another after another. And I figure out this is a good teachable moment for my adolescent. And I approach him and I say, 'Look, you see those kids? That's why you have to be careful about drinking.'" And he told Rabbi Krukpa that his son looked at him and said, "Abba, that's exactly how you and your friends look when you come back from kiddush club every Shabbos." And he said, "It hit him. It hit him. You know? It hit him what message he was giving about what was important to him and what message he was giving." And he said, "Rabbi Krukpa, you were 100% right." Big man to be able to say that. But that's that piece in terms of menschmaking. And the final piece, before I move on to another section here, is the piece of, we're hearing about balance before. I want to talk a little bit about balance from a parenting standpoint. I was speaking at Nefesh a couple of nights ago, and we were talking about how important it is to listen to your children, hear them out, and listen to those who we disagree with and hear them out. And, you know, the well-known saying in psychology, to be understood, first understand. If you want to be understood by your adolescent and your young adult child, first understand them. It's no accident that the word ozen and the word maznayim, or scale, have a similar etymology. There's something balancing that comes out from hearing and listening. After I said that, an officer, David Cohn, came over to me, and he pointed out that very often inner ear problems, if we have an inner ear problem, it will manifest itself as a balancing problem. Again, ozen maznayim. It's tremendously balancing to hear a person out. So the third ingredient for research shows is the balance between love and limits between Moldo, Chaz, Chazal tell us, and Yimei Mekarebes, right? Chazal tell us, in the Gemara in Sanhedrin and a few other times in Shas, that the key in dealing with our children, including our adolescents, is to find a balance between the left hand, interestingly the weaker hand, pushing away, that's the limit part, and the right hand bringing closer. And the research shows that when you have that balance, when you have that left-right balance, that left-right push, that's called authoritative parenting. And either other extreme is no good. All authoritarian, all limits, no love, gives birth actually to juvenile delinquents. And the same thing happens if you never say no, if it's all love and no limits. So either what they call overindulgent parenting or authoritarian parenting, either extreme is not good. And all the research comes out with exactly what Chazal told us thousands of years ago. It's the middle. The middle, the balance between the left and the right. Beautiful Dvar Torah from beautiful thoughts from Rav Wasserman, or Simcha Wasserman. It's a wonderful, brilliant insight into parenting. He said, what happens if you literally put into play what the Gemara tells us, and you take a child, you put the child in front of you, and you simultaneously push him away with your left hand while bringing him closer with your right hand? You could try this with your adolescents when you get home tonight. He says, what happens if you do that left-right push? You turn them around. Great insight. And a great, great insight. And that's what the research shows on matchmaking. The way to make an honorable mensch is to find that balance, including with adolescents, including with that age. They want limits. I can't tell you how many times I can remember offhand 3 to 4 times for sure, where now that I've been practicing long enough, I'd have adolescents in my office who would go crazy when their parents would put limits on them and say, you have to have this kind of curfew, Mose Shabbos, and you can't go out on a school night, and they scream and yell and say, all my friends are allowed out on school nights. And I get to meet that friend, by the way. Maybe he lives in Baltimore, I don't know. And they go crazy, and they scream and yell. And the more they screamed and yelled, the more tension would come, and the more distance would come. And then I see that same adolescent later on, when they brought me their children. Because I'm into the next generation now. And be careful with your child. Never wish on your child. I just hope that one day you'll have children just like you. That often comes true. They'll come to me with their child and with similar issues. And on three occasions, for sure, that I can think of, I've had adolescents who were in my office screaming and yelling about the limits come to me and say, remember I was going crazy in your office? Remember that? And now they're with the next generation of kids coming to me and they say, deep down, I was happy my parents were saying that. Deep down, I needed them to say no, and I knew it. Or, as this beautiful Medrash says, it's a great Medrash, it's a Pasuk in Mishlei, says, Yasser bincha p'yesh titfa ve'el hamiso al tite nafshecha. Right? Put Yasser, use musar on your child. Correct your child. Chastise your child. There's always hope. Ve'el hamiso al tite nafshecha. Don't pay attention to his or her screaming and yelling and crying. So there's an incredible medrash on this pasuk. The medrash says, kol hamosiv av yisurin al bino mosif haben ahava al aviv. Totally non-Western concept. Totally non-Western. It's amazing. You hear what the Medrash says? It says, the more a parent puts limits on his child, right, the more that child will love that parent. And it's so true. So true. I see it, and I see it. You may not see it or hear it or believe it while it's happening, but deep down they know that if you care enough about them, you're going to do that part of it. So again, it's that balance, the balance between the left hand doing the limit, interestingly the weaker hand, and the right hand spending time bringing closer. And one closing point about this, that I wanted to make is that I was in California last year, and there was a kid who was, I guess today would be called an at-risk kid, you know? A kid at odds with his parents, terribly rebellious when I was a kid. He was in my class. And in spite of a good yeshiva education, he eluded the rest of the community. And he ran off, and the last I heard was that he had intermarried. He was no longer, you know, part of the community at all. He married a non-Jew. And everybody had written him off. I'm spending Shabbos at a shul in California, and I'm davening. It's Shabbos morning, and I see three rows ahead of me a guy who I could swear is the same guy, sitting down and davening with two little kids, including one who, you know, didn't have the haircut yet because he wasn't quite three yet. You know, his son, who was cute little kids. And I was thinking, that can't be him. And I turned to my husband and I say, is that who I think it is? And he says, oh yeah, he's from your neighborhood growing up, and tells me the name. I couldn't believe it. So I go over to him after davening to this guy, and I say, you know, so nice to see you. And I tell him, you know, he knew I was there, but I said, what happened? He said that, you know, things didn't work out with his first wife, and he ended up realizing that he needed to come back into the community, and he found a wonderful Jewish woman, and he married her, and now his kids are getting a full yeshiva education. He's back. Tells me I'm back. So I asked him, what was your secret? What brought you back? Everybody had sort of given up on you. And he said, you know something? He said, my father never stopped holding my hand. Beautiful, beautiful image. Okay? Beautiful image. He said, my father never stopped holding my hand. He never gave up on me. He said, the community gave up on me. Just about everybody gave up on me. Even my mother gave up on me a little bit. But my father, he obviously didn't approve of my choices. But I knew that his love for me continued. He just stayed in there. He said he never let go. He never let go. And that's what brought me back. Okay? So that's the ultimate in terms of menschmaking. It's the connection. It's the hug. I think it's the stronger right hand, the yamin v'kareves, that ultimately through time and through proper example and through that proper balance between the love and the limits and the proper shifua is ultimately going to bring kids back. Okay, so that's the end of part one. Okay, part two. Part two is actually, this is I think in some ways more important because this is actually the heart of what I wanted to talk to you about because it has to do more with stuff that often doesn't get talked about. I want to talk to you about a little bit about something that, for some reason, we don't teach necessarily, and it's the what matters in life, okay, in terms of adolescence, and in terms of our kids going into adulthood. I want to talk a little bit about happiness, a little bit about some thinking about what is it that modern psychology teaches us about happiness. So with the remaining, I think it's 15 minutes left. When did I start? Okay. So I want to talk to you a little bit about happiness. I do want to leave time for questions and comments and first of all hear, you know, some thoughts from you all about how to make this as relevant as we can. Why is happiness important? And I'll tell you what the relevance is to talking about parenting adolescents and young adults. Is if you ask the average American, what is it that would make you happy? Okay, so let me go back. They started doing this every year with thousands upon thousands of entering freshmen in colleges throughout the country, starting in the 1950s. And the number one answer back in the 50s is when they asked them, they actually asked a little bit different. They said, what matters most? What do you want to accomplish most in life now that you're setting off on life and beginning college? And then it was things like meaning. It was being part of the community. Making money barely made it into the top of the list. The last 20 years or so, what do you think is number one on the list? Making money. But the most important thing in life is to make money. And in fact, that's what informs all kinds of choices by many kids who follow the path of going on to college and going into the professions, and in terms of what drives them, is often making money. Not necessarily in our world. We'll contrast it to that. But I want to talk a little bit about it, because I know that very often what's been happening throughout our world is that our children are becoming more firm than we are. Not always. I know sometimes it's they're becoming less so, and sometimes it's the same, and sometimes it's a little bit more to the right. And I want to talk about that part of this stage of life, that part of parenting. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what does the research tell us about this? Because it's important. So you ask the average American, what is it that you think would make you more happy? And almost everybody says money. And let me talk about that for a few minutes, and then I want to talk to you about what is it, in fact, that does make you happy, because money doesn't make you happy. You don't need me to tell you this, but I wanted to talk about it. It turns out that the more money you make, the more you want to make. Psychologists call it the principle of relative deprivation. As long as there's somebody who makes a little bit more money than you do, you're going to feel relatively poor. I could go into literally dozens of studies that show this, but the bottom line, I'll give you just one quick example. December, a number of years ago, a man comes into my office, full-blown clinical depression. Young guy, maybe in his late 20s, investment banker from New York City. And I asked him, why are you depressed? He says, because we just got our end-of-year bonuses. And he's depressed. He's like really depressed. He couldn't sleep, he couldn't eat, it was already some time since the bonus had come in, and he was like beyond a state of yish. So I said, what happened? You didn't get much of a bonus? You didn't get any bonus? He said, I got a $500,000 bonus. I said, oh, okay. You know, so why are you depressed? And he said, I know it sounds crazy. He said, but the guy in the office next to me got a $750,000 bonus. Okay? He said, and I'm every bit as good as he is. And he literally was depressed over his $500,000 bonus. Let me tell you a quick story, and then I'll try to go to the ingredients of happiness. I'll try to make it relevant to what tonight is about. Robert Frank. Story of Robert Frank, a well-known economist, a fairly well-off guy, writes a lot of books, is a well-known professor. And he tells the following story. It's an incredible story. He was an idealistic guy, comes out of college, and he volunteers for the Peace Corps. And they sent him to Nepal to be a teacher for 2 years in Nepal. They meet him at the airport, and they drive him to some place in the middle of Nepal, in the middle of nowhere, and they take him to a little hut, no running water, no electricity, okay? And they tell him it's where you're going to spend the next 2 years. So he says, are you kidding? And they say goodbye. See you in a couple of years. Okay, and they leave and smile at him and wave and go away. And he thinks to himself, how am I going to survive 2 years in this hovel with no water and no electricity? But he said within a week or so, he was totally used to it. Everybody around him also had a hovel with no running water and no electricity. And that became his new reality. It's like our kids getting used to camp every year, you know? But then he said something fascinating happened. He gets his first paycheck. His first paycheck was for $40. And he discovered that he was going to be making $40 a month for his 2 years in Nepal. Again, he's very upset. How am I going to live on $40 a month? Until he discovered that everybody in town was making at most $30 a month. So he was making $10 more a month than anybody in that whole area. And he goes on to write that he never felt wealthier in his life than he did during the 2 years that he spent living in a one-room hut with no water and no electricity in rural Nepal on $40 a month. Right? You know, it's such a Musar Haskell, right? It's not the money. It's other things that make us happy. So let me just quickly review for you what in fact makes us happy and what does that tell us about our roles in developing our children to the next level when they're adolescents and young adults. In order to get at that, I'm going to start with a quick enigma. quick enigma. The enigma is a puzzle, and it's a puzzle that really got me thinking about this topic. Highlight Point Retreat a couple of years ago. So I'm at a Highlight Point Retreat, right? So it's a Shabbos for families of children with cancer and other serious illnesses. It's an unbelievable experience that I've been so glad to be part of for the last 15 years since they started. So I'm sitting in a Highlight Point Retreat, and it's the Shabbos just before Mincha. So I really spent a lot of intense time with these families. And people are really opening up at this point. And one of the beautiful things about Highlight Point Retreats are you have the whole spectrum. You can have a Satmar Chassid sitting next to an intermarried Jew. I once had a Reformed Jew who was intermarried talk to me Motzei Shabbos at a Highlight Point Retreat. And he said before this weekend, he was actually from here, from Washington, D.C., high-powered lawyer in a big firm in D.C., and he says, you know something, before this weekend, I hated the Hasids. I hated them. I just didn't like them. And my friends hated the Hasids. He said, after this weekend, if one of my friends even says the slightest bad word about those Hasids, I'm going to beat him up senseless. Okay? That's what a Highlight Point Retreat does. Just two short days. That's what it has done. And that's what it does. It forges these unbelievable relationships. So Chassid is sitting down, and he says, you know something? He says, this past Rosh Hashanah, my son was diagnosed with leukemia. And Yom Kippur, I'm sitting in shul and davening, and a wave of happiness washes over me like I've never experienced in my entire life. And I think, like, what does this mean? But then even more surprising to me is I look around the room, and everybody, all the parents, are crying and nodding in agreement. Like they knew exactly what he meant. So it really got me thinking. So let me try to answer the enigma and bring it into a little bit of what our role is as parents of kids and the kind of values we want to teach them in terms of the real matchmaking. Here's what the research shows. The research shows that the happiness doesn't come from the F of funds. It comes from the other three Fs. Another three Fs. Any guesses on what those three Fs are? We always have fun with this because there's such interesting answers. Family is one. Excellent. Yes. Friends. Any other guesses? Only one left. Usually when I speak to a group of high school girls, they say food, which I find very interesting. High school boys give me some other Fs that I can't talk about, that I'd rather not talk about. But the girls almost always will say food. And boys will say things like fun, you know, or other things. And almost nobody gets the third F. Huh? Freedom's not bad, but it's actually faith. It's faith. So let me run you through those three Fs and then bring it back to this concept. First, I'll talk a little bit about friends and community. A little bit about friends and community. And I'll share with you, I won't go into tremendous detail about it, but I'll talk to you about something I spoke about earlier this week. Some of you, it's I think, a fascinating issue. There really is a connection between friends and community and happiness. It's Seaborg. So I'll tell you study and a Dvar Torah, and then I'll move on. Study. Rosetto, Pennsylvania. Rosetto, Pennsylvania is a town in western Pennsylvania that had almost nobody die young. That incredibly long longevity in Rosetto. So a group of medical epidemiologists look into this, and they're fascinated by it. This doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And they go in, and they figure maybe it's lifestyle, maybe they eat healthier, maybe they exercise more. No, if anything, they're a little lazier and a little bit of a less healthy lifestyle than the surrounding towns. So they go and they do some intensive research here, and here's what they find about Rosetto. They find that Rosetto was settled in the late 1800s by a group of immigrants from southern Italy. And it had a tremendously strong sense of community. People really cared about each other. And there was a lot of active religious observance, a lot of volunteering, a lot of community work. And old people were valued. And they'd sit on their front porches on their rockers, and if they saw a teenager cut school, the whole town would drag him or her by the ear and present them to the principal, so you couldn't act up in Rosetto even if you wanted to. You couldn't. You had. The older generation was taking care of them. And there was that sense of access, that sense of community. Starting in the 1980s, the new generation decided that they had it with the old Italian folkways, and they started to start rejecting Rosetto a little bit and the values of Rosetto. And what they did was, is they even changed the architecture of that town. So you no longer built homes with front porches. You now had a garage door. You'd click the garage door opener and you'd go in, and you could live and die on the same block in Rosetto and never know who your neighbor was. The sense of office, the sense of friendship, the sense of kahila vanished. Today, Rosetto has the highest death rate of any town in western Pennsylvania. Okay? People die younger there than any other town in that area. The sense of office, the sense of community went away. And let me end this section with a beautiful Dvar Torah from a friend of mine, David Fox, that is at a Nefesh conference a few years ago, was the psychologist. Oh, you said it. You said it here. Okay. You said it. Okay, good. No. I could do something else. It's right. It's but it's the beautiful, the sense of Sibur it's a great part of Torah, really is. No. I could do other stuff. There's this beautiful, I'm trying to think. I'll do it now. I could use the time in a lot of other ways. Why shouldn't we get new stuff? I'm not here that often. So that's the F of friends. The F of friends. By the way, if people, for example, who value friendships over career, just as one example, have far happier lifestyles and are just more satisfied with their lives than those who value career over happiness. Number of studies. That's just one more example of that. Friends, I did family. I could go on and on about family. We don't really need to talk about that because that's so obvious, right? You know, there's this myth that people who are married are maybe not as happy as people who aren't, and the reality is that the vast majority of couples, first of all, the divorce rates are way overstated. The divorce rate of 50% isn't true. That's based on including people who are married and remarried and remarried again. Actually, marriages are held on to a far greater percentage, especially in our world, than people think. But also, the vast majority of people in the United States, if you ask them, who's your best friend? You know what they answer? They answer their spouse. And in fact, people who are married tend to be healthier and tend to be happier. And the whole idea of Tavla Mesev, Tandu Mila Mesev Arma, the whole idea, the concept that marriage and family is the source of what really matters in life is something that I don't even want to spend time on because it's so obvious. I could tell you many, many studies, but it's just a fact. It's a fact. There's one set of studies where, what if they look at something like happiness level of married people in something like over 50 countries around the world. I don't think they found a single study that doesn't show that connection. Okay? Obviously, if marriage is distressed, your happiness level is going to go down. But if you have a solid marriage, it's the gateway to happiness. It really is. And then finally, faith. Faith, when I went to graduate school, many years ago, it was a number of years ago, it was about about 30 years ago that I finished my doctorate, almost 30 years ago. And back then, there was tremendous anti-religious sentiments in the field. I mean, they were describing religion as a manic obsessive compulsive neurosis. They all thought I was out of my mind and I should be in therapy to get the religion out of me. It was horrible. All my colleagues found the same thing. But it was based on a Freudian view of religion that was shaped by his own experiences with his grandfather and other family members. It wasn't based on any research. Freud basically made it up, you know, that religion was a massive study. He made it up. It wasn't based on anything. What's happened in the last couple of decades is there's been a tremendous amount of research on the connection between religion and adjustment. And to my knowledge, there isn't a single study that doesn't show that people who are actively observant, a real internal emuna, aren't better adjusted and happier and even healthier than people who aren't. To the point that every day a week that a person goes to Minyan, there's correspondingly increased levels of happiness. You could use this, okay? Increased levels of happiness, you can also, okay? Compared to that. So if you go to Minyan once a week, you're happier than if you don't go at all. Twice a week, happier than once. Direct linear correlation. But really interesting. You know, for a variety of reasons. People just help better when they have everything that religion brings to life. So how does that answer the enigma? The way it answers the enigma is happiness as simcha as shum moach. Shum moach. It's where your head is at. As the Baal Shem Tov would say, b'makom shemashacha shel adam shum hu ha'ish. What happiness is about is having your head connected to what matters and connected to meaning. That's the simcha. It's the simcha of Ivdu is Hashem the simcha. It's the simcha, not the simcha of a New Year's party and going out and getting drunk. Not the passing simcha of getting that new Lexus or that new car or that raise, where the literature shows that, in the literature called miswanting, that when you get that, your happiness is much less long-lasting than one would ever imagine. After a while, the novelty wears off, literally in a matter sometimes of hours or at most weeks. Lasting happiness comes from shamoa, from connecting to the three F's of family, friends, and faith. And that's the message that I wanted to bring to you in terms of that part of parenting adolescents and young adults, because I think that sometimes we lose sight of that. And sometimes when we're guiding our children, I'm not saying it's not important. It's very expensive to have a firm lifestyle. We have to pay. Do yeshivas here charge tuition at all? Is there? So we have to pay. They do. I have a feeling. I thought New York was the only place. You know, obviously there's some hard, harsh realities. But we sometimes lose sight of the fact that sometimes our children do us proud by connecting in a much more idealistic way to what really matters, and to a way that what parent doesn't wish for their child that their child be happy and satisfied and lead a full productive life? And thank God we're living in an era where that's beginning to happen more and more through connection in ways that wasn't happening in the past to the three F's that matter. And I think that that's a very important message. One last series of thoughts, and then I'll end it. And that has to do with one other part of parenting adolescents. What that has to do with is parenting young adults also. It has to do with looking at the big picture. I hear this all the time. Very often, you know, adolescence is the time, well, the new research is showing, it's the time where kids are temporarily a little bit crazy. The new neurobiology research is showing that we have much better ways of understanding the developing brain. That during adolescence, kids go through a temporary period where their brains go offline to a certain extent. Their judgment suffers, their ability to see things through the eyes of others suffers. Adolescents are into novelty seeking and risk taking in a way that they never are in any other stage of their life. They have less judgment and more impaired thinking than they do before they hit adolescence. And then our job is to figure out a way to try to channel that. And it's just important to look at the big picture. The big picture is, again, it's that holding their hands through this and having them stay connected in spite of everything that might happen. And let me end with two stories. One story is a story that I heard recently from a good friend of ours. We were sitting down together, and we were just talking. We were having dinner together, and they told me about one of their kids who is married and has kids of their own. And they were saying, you know, we had an ongoing battle throughout his adolescence. They tell me about their son, that he never wore tzitzis. He hated tzitzis. He hated the way it felt. He hated the way he despised symptoms. And there'd be almost daily fights between father and son, and mother and son, especially father and son about symptoms, to the point that it really impacted on their relationship a little bit. But they just kept it up, but nothing worked. Nothing worked. Okay, you know, they're... In other ways, he was a wonderful kid, and he grew up, and he moved out of the house. Still, not really wearing tzitzis to their knowledge. You know, they could force them to wear the tzitzis. They'd find it, like, hidden in the bushes behind their house or something. And they were never very successful. It turned out that I think either the night before or the week before we had dinner with our friends, they told us about an amazing phone call they got from this son. They said that this son's oldest son had come home from his preschool class, all excited, because he had learned about tzitzis. And he learned about the bracha you make on tzitzis. And he comes running into the house, and he goes over, runs over to his father, and he says, "Abba, Abba, I want to make a bracha on your tzitzis. Can you take your tzitzis out? I want to make a bracha on your tzitzis." And it hit him. It hit him for the first time, this young father, what all those years, you know, before he'd been hearing over and over again from his father. And he owned it for the first time. He pulled up his father and he said, "Abba, I just want to tell you something." He told him the story. He said, "I will never, another day will never go by without me wearing my tzitzis." Okay? And it's that big picture that I think we have to keep our eye open. You know, again, as long as we keep holding their hand, we do the limits. We don't always have control over it. We also have to think about the big picture. Adolescence is often the period of life that is the lowest level of religious development. And as long as we can keep connected, ultimately they often come back. And as long as we keep our eye on the big picture about what really matters and guide them and model for them in that way, it makes an enormous difference. Let me end with the final story. It's the story of hope. It's the story I told at the Nefesh a couple of nights ago. And it's on my mind because it just happened to me about a week and a half ago. I was in Sri Lanka for 9 days, which is a very, very strange thing for a nice Jewish boy to do. But my main secular area of focus is in post-traumatic stress disorder, and I do a lot of work in various places related to traumatic stuff. There's a binational trauma commission with Israel and the United States, and they asked me to go with a small team of people who do work in trauma, to work with the therapists, to work with the people who were devastated by the tsunami. And I spent 9 days there, fascinating 9 days. What I learned there was unbelievable in terms of how different, and how much we have to be grateful for, basic things we need to be grateful for. But I want to end with this story I heard from one of the doctors who was there. One of the doctors said that the day the tsunami came, he saw it coming, and it was. He said, "You have no idea what the terror was." And he said he knew that he immediately in his surroundings was his grandmother, mother, and daughter, I believe. I'm not positive. I think it was three immediate family members. He knew he had to save them. And he puts them on his shoulder, and with superhuman strength that can happen in times of trauma, he runs to the top of the hill near his house and barely manages to get away with his life, and he saves these three family members. And he's looking down on his town, and he's in a state of yish, and he thinks to himself, "How can I just stay here? I got my family to safety, but what about my friends? What about the rest of the town?" And he told me that what comes flashing through his mind, because he doesn't know why, what comes flashing through his mind was something that his third grade teacher told him. His third grade teacher told him, if something is difficult, you have to do it. If something's impossible, you just have to try a little bit harder. And he said it just comes flashing in his mind, and it energizes. And he runs back down, and he told me he saved 9 other people with that mantra running through his head. If something's impossible, you have to try a little harder. He kept going, and he took people out of the rubble, and he kept going to this high place. He saved 9 more people. And that's the message I want to leave you with. It's the message of Mat Min Ha'or Do Taharve Min Achosha. A little bit of light, little sparks of light that we're constantly lighting for our children, our grandchildren, that we're constantly doing, hopefully, in terms of our efforts to raise our children on the proper way, right? Our adolescents, our children as they move on into the next stage of life, and some of the stresses of the sandwich generation, sometimes you lose sight of the forest for the trees, and you lose sight of the fact very often we're doing all kinds of stuff that really makes a difference without us even realizing it. Just we don't see it right away. That third grade teacher will probably never know that she saved those 9 lives. But she did. She did. You know, very often we're planting seeds with our children and with our students and with the general community. So with that hopefully happy note, let's get some discussion going. So why don't you...